Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Aging with Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast with Maureen Halligan. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Christina Sadowski and Dr. Tae-Hwan Chun. Dr. Sadowski is Clinical Director of the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, a program caring for both children and adults with spinal cord related paralysis, and built on the philosophy that functional restoration is activity dependent and can be best achieved through structured medico-rehabilitative interventions. Dr. Sadowski's research interests center on prevention of complications in patients with paralysis and the efficacy of activity-based restorative therapies in helping individuals with long-term spinal cord injury and paralysis recover sensation, movement, and independence. She has published in highly regarded specialty-related peer-reviewed journals, wrote chapters in seminal specialty books, has organized numerous courses and seminars, and has been invited to lecture in different universities and at national and international meetings. Dr. Tae-Hwan Chung is an assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation and neurology at Johns Hopkins. His areas of training and expertise include neuromuscular disorders and physical medicine and rehabilitation. Thanks to his diverse background, Dr. Chung is uniquely positioned to diagnose and treat a variety of neuromuscular conditions and pathology by using electrodiagnostic procedures and immune and rehabilitative treatments. Dr. Chung is particularly interested in rehabilitative treatments and therapeutic exercise for various neuromuscular diseases, such as myositis, peripheral neuropathy, and motor neuron diseases. Dr. Chung runs a multidisciplinary rehabilitation clinic with the Johns Hopkins Neuromuscular Rehabilitation Team, which he helped develop with physical, occupational, and speech therapists, who are dedicated to helping patients with rare neuromuscular diseases. And again, I am Gigi DeFebri with the TMA, and we're also joined by Maureen Halligan, who is co-moderating. Maureen, would you mind just giving a little introduction about yourself?
Hello to everyone who's listening. And I am, I was asked to be part of this panel, mainly because I had transverse myelitis at age 15 and now, unbelievable, even to myself, I'm 65 years old. So that's 5 decades of dealing with everything that comes with that package, dealing with paralysis and everything that goes along with it. At the time, there was no MRIs available to help in diagnosis, and I had spent 3 months in the hospital, had no steroids, no plasmapheresis, not even much physical therapy in the hospital. And when I returned home, I came only able to crawl and didn't even really have any assistive devices at home at the time. I got a pair of crutches, and that's how I got around. Went back to high school briefly in a wheelchair, but mostly ambulated with the crutches. And from then on, I was pretty much on my own, walking in later years unassisted and probably doing quite a bit of damage to myself, just getting from point A to point B, because I used my body in ways that it wasn't designed to be used. But anyway, persevered, and then through the years, I think I was basically wearing myself out and began to experience pain, which led me to getting one cane, then two canes, then a wheelie walker, and that's basically where I'm ambulating at today, mostly using my walker. Okay, so kind of like a quick take on where I am.
Yes, thank you.
And how I got here.
Thanks, Maureen.
There's a lot of detail in there that I'm just trying to be really brief. It's hard to speak of 50 years of life in 20 sentences or less, but here we are.
Right. Well, thank you. And, you know, your perspective, too, as we go through the questions is very much appreciated. So, so to start, you know, thank you to everyone for joining us today. Dr. Chung, would you mind just kind of giving a brief overview on aging in general from your perspective?
Sure. So again, my name is Dr. Tae Chung. I'm an assistant professor of physical medicine rehabilitation and have a second appointment in neurology. I have a fellowship training in both spinal cord injury and neuromuscular medicine. then I'm seeing kind of various patients, particularly more various neuromuscular disorders. For research, I have been investigating the effect of normal aging on spinal motor neurons, meaning motor neurons in the spinal cord. And it's been really well known that motor function declines with aging, meaning everybody, their muscle strength declines with aging. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people probably have noticed, or you know, like in their family member noticed that you know, their skeletal muscle strength declined, meaning they're weaker than they used to be compared to when they are teenagers, 20s and 30s. Now, this is actually a very important question in aging research field, because the onset of muscle weakness with aging really predicts disability in late life and sometimes even death. So people have been investigating trying to find what's really causing motor decline with aging, or you know, what's causing it, whether it's the muscle degeneration or nerve degeneration. There's a growing consensus that aging muscle weakness probably comes from a little bit of both, meaning muscle degeneration and nerve degeneration. However, more recently, there's been growing interest in the motor function in the spinal cord and motor neuron degeneration. There have been actually a lot of clinical research, more from autopsy studies, showing that there's a reducing number of motor neurons in the spinal cord, and people have been suspecting that this is somehow related to declining in motor function with normal aging. And in my research, I'm particularly interested in a few metabolic pathways that we know are related to normal aging and decline. And you know, our lab has been just working on trying to prove the association between those metabolic pathways and normal aging. Now, that being said, a lot of aging and neuromuscular decline research has been based on, you know, the petri dish research or animal models, but we haven't yet to gone to a lot of clinical trials. Of course, our aim is to you know, find out what's really causing the motor neuron decline in aging and prevent this muscle strength weakness with aging, and eventually prevent just the disability in late life. Now, although we don't know a lot about, you know, this aging and motor function decline, I think I'd be happy to answer any questions related to it. And particularly for transverse myelitis and spinal cord injury, we now know that, you know, these people start from the very lower number of motor neurons in the spinal cord. So I think probably the normal aging process happens same in the transverse myelitis patients and spinal cord injury patients in general, but their muscle weakness may, you know, present more dramatically compared to other normal aging people. So, so I'll be happy to answer any questions during the discussion and introduction so far.
Great. Thank you. This is a really good overview. And then Dr. Sadowski, would you mind giving your brief presentation on, you know, aging and spinal cord, you know, related disease and paralysis more specifically?
Sure. I hope everybody hears me. I wanted to introduce a couple of concepts to start with. There is a chronological age, which the medical subject heading describes as being 65 or older. So you're old over 65 as a disease, if you want to call it that way. There is a biological age, and the biological age is basically the burden of comorbidities on your body. It's how old your body acts. And then there is a sociological age, which basically is, well, whatever the society expects of you to do, the expectations, and however you feel and work into the society. It's basically that concept that you're as old as you feel or you think you are. So those are three different concepts on aging. And all three of them are influenced or impacted if you have paralysis. Another way to look at the effects of the aging when you have paralysis is depends on when were you injured in the context of aging. Have you aged with paralysis or have you aged into paralysis? Aging with paralysis is when you had an injury early in life, and we definitely have Helen here that can talk about this, and she did talk about this a little bit. Aging into paralysis is when something occurs when you're over 65 that impairs your neurologic function, and the most common example on that is the myelopathy, cervical myelopathies that are related to degenerative changes that occur in the spinal canal because of overuse, neck pain, back pain, so forth. Both of them apply to individuals that had a spinal cord injury or paralysis in the early age onset. That said, I have to say that aging with paralysis brings a couple of terms that are not common to the able-bodied world. There is a concept of disability paradox, and the disability paradox is explained when people with serious or persistent disability report good or excellent quality of life, even when outsiders might regard their health and quality of life as poor. And then there is this concept of healthy survivorship concept, and that identifies key differences in populations that perceive themselves as having a high burden of disease versus the ones that don't. So two individuals that are aging with paralysis, one that has individual A has a lot of complications throughout, and then the other one maybe has an easier ride, and they separate, so they test differently and they respond differently. Two 50-year-olds that have been injured early at the age of, let's say, 15, because we have an example here, they will respond differently to with their biological age and their sociological age at the age of 50, according to the burden of disease. With all those definitions, I think that how I wanted to approach aging in individuals with paralysis, specifically related to spinal cord diseases, to look what is aging doing to different systems. So first, let's take the neural function and its ability to recover. Dr. Chung already mentioned that aging has an impact on motor neuron birth or neurogenesis, meaning the birth of new cells. Now, while it is not proven that there is a decrease in the ability of the motor neuron in the spinal cord to regenerate, there is enough data to show that in the hippocampus, frontal lobe, and the brainstem, there is decreased neurogenesis. So with age, so aging decreases the ability of the motor of new motor cells to be born. Now in the spinal cord specifically, because of those age-related spondylotic degenerative changes that happen specifically at the cervical spine in the neck, there is all of those degenerative arthritic changes can exert compression on the anterior motor horn, meaning on the structure of the cord, the gray matter of the cord that actually houses the motor neuron. So the function of the motor neuron could be affected because of the spondylotic changes. So that's the effect of aging, in a nutshell, effect of aging on the motor neuron. The nervous system also has myelin, which is the white substance that coats the nerve and ensures rapid transmission of the information. And there is animal data saying that there is decreased ability of the myelin to recover as we age. Again, it has not been directly proven in individuals with spinal cord related paralysis. The nervous system works because it has the motor neuron, because it has nerve, and because it forms connections. We call those synapses. So when we try to learn a movement, we repeat that movement, and at some point it becomes easier. The same when we try to remember a poem, we repeat that poem and it becomes easier. Why? It's because of the synapse formation and facilitation. Now, aging does decrease, alters the functional connectivity in between neural structures. And that is more evident at the brain level, but the brain contains the motor cortex, which is the generator of the movement. Without us thinking about movement and having this map of movement in the brain, we can't move. So that's the connection in between synapse formation and connectivity and aging. It's decreased. From pathologic point of view, there is some data that shows that people that have a spinal cord injury and are older, that have poorer prognosis for gait, for ability to walk, that motor neuron disease is accelerated and the ability to recover is compromised with advanced age in the animal model of a motor neuron disease, specifically ALS. And then there is this ischemic myelopathy, meaning kind of like a spinal cord attack, like a heart attack, a spinal cord attack, or decreased perfusion, vascular perfusion in the spinal cord, which accentuates the motor deficit that is related to the spinal cord, to the original spinal cord injury. As it comes with age effect on function, we learn harder. It's harder to learn how to move. So motor tasks are harder. It's harder to learn how to play tennis if you're 50 versus if you're 20. Well, if you have a paralysis related to a spinal cord condition, and if you need to learn motor tasks, either new ones or some that you lost because you were debilitated by, let's say, surgery or an intercurrent illness, you were admitted with pneumonia and laid in bed, and then you have the ability to transfer, but now you lost it because you were in the hospital for six weeks, it's harder to learn how to transfer again because you're older. There is also an effect on cognition. because in order to learn how to do a motor task, you need to be able to be cognitively aware of the motor task. And so age decreases the speed of processing of thoughts, the working memory, the long-term memory, and also inhibits or alters the inhibitory function. So sometimes you're more impulsive, which leads to more accidents. Function-wise, there is an increased need for assistance and for activities of daily living. And one social thing that actually probably gets lost when you have a paralysis related to spinal cord disease and you have a secondary complication, like the example I gave with the pneumonia, you're admitted into hospital for something, there is less likelihood that the primary team will refer you to a rehabilitation unit because of the referral process, because they think that, hey, you know, you're paralyzed, and we're not going to send you to rehab. And that actually takes the your ability to regain the skills even more prominently down, because not only that you start with a lower level, but now you don't even get the help to improve those skills. There are some good things about when you're aging with paralysis. There is this notion called resilient aging. So people that have longer lasting paralysis related to spinal cord disease, they have actually less worries about their concerning health in social studies, not compared with individuals that have that are aging into paralysis or with able-bodied individuals. And I know you guys can argue with me on that one, but I do believe that the resiliency, I see it every day in my practice. Maybe we sweat the small stuff a little bit less. And there are studies that show that there is increased satisfaction with employment in individuals that are aging with paralysis. But the bad part is that you have all the secondary health complications, and there is a host of systems that are affected by aging with paralysis, and those are the muscle and tendons, and you have atrophy, pain, injury and overuse, bone, you have low bone mass, osteoporosis, frailty, fractures that are more common than in able-bodied. On skin, individuals with aging with paralysis have more pressure ulcers, especially if there are non-traumatic spinal cord diseases, specifically like multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, so forth. You have the degenerative changes that are accentuated. The original neurogenic bowel changes are, the comorbidity is accentuated. You get more age-induced or drug-induced complication. There is a concept of small bacterial intestinal overgrowth, and I see that a lot more and more in my practice. People that have had a long-standing bowel program, and somehow when they get to be a little bit older, it all fails and it changes, and there is a lot of bloating. There are increased renal and bladder stones. Autonomic function, the blood pressure, the ability to regulate the blood pressure goes changes, so there are a lot of very high or very low blood pressures that are symptomatic. There is increased likelihood of obstructive sleep apnea, pneumonia, respiratory insufficiency. Immune system doesn't work so good, so the concept of inflammatory aging or immunosenescence. And that plays a role when your original injury was an autoimmune dysfunction. And then there are a lot of metabolic changes that are specific, that are on top of the metabolic changes induced by paralysis. Paralysis affects your glucose, your carbohydrates metabolism, and your lipid metabolism, mostly because the muscle is the factory where all these metabolic changes are occurring, and there is atrophy related to paralysis, and now you have the added secondary effects of aging. So there are increased hospitalizations with these comorbidities. And what I found in my review of the literature was kind of funny. Men that are aging with paralysis said that aging is more complicated and difficult, but women said that aging is accelerated when you have spinal cord disease-related paralysis. So that's my overview.
Thank you. That was a great overview. You covered, I think, a lot of some of the broader areas that we're going to be talking about with specific questions from our community. So I appreciate it. So I think we should just jump into some of the questions now. Let me see. So you talk a little bit about issues with particular like body functions that change just as you age in general, and then with paralysis as another issue. So we got one question. Someone was diagnosed with TM at the age of 12, from T4 downwards, and they were told it was due to a viral infection. So they are now 57, and over the course of 6 months have been getting weaker by the day. And their MRI scans are showing degenerative changes, like the spinal canal is narrowed. And, is this something that happens? Could this be a reason for increased weakness?
So I'm going to take this one because I already talked a little bit about it. And,
yep.
And yes, this has to do with the spondyloarthropathy and subsequent myeloradiculopathy. So let's put this in regular words. The spinal canal, which is housing the spinal cord, gets arthritic degenerative changes, and that manifests as narrowing of all of the openings. The openings are housing the spinal cord per se, and if that opening gets stenotic, gets narrowed, that means that there is compression on the spinal cord with resulting myelopathy, that means more damage to the spinal cord. If the openings are on the side of the spinal canal where the nerves that are starting in the cord and going out into the arms or the legs or the trunk are coming out, those are called foraminal narrowing, foraminal stenosis, and that puts pressure on the nerve per se, giving what we call a lower motor neuron injury. Anyway, both of them will rob you of motor and sensory of motor function, or can rob you of motor function and can give you pain. So this occurs in able-bodied individuals. It is more accelerated in people that overuse their neck and back because of the paralysis. So yes, that can definitely play a role in getting weaker. I am going to throw in the concept of spinal cord tethering too, just in case. So when you have an original injury that affects the structures that are actually protecting the spinal cord, there are some coverings, the dura mater, pia mater, arachnoid covering. If those can get inflamed, or if they can adhere, they can clump to the spinal canal on the inside, and they can tether the cord to one level. So every time you bend and extend, you actually stretch the cord and induce more damage because the cord is fixed, tethered to the canal at one point. So those are all possible causes of decreasing neurologic, specifically motor function, and ensuing neuropathic pain and chronic musculoskeletal pain.
Just to add a little bit to Dr. Sadowski's comment, I completely agree with all the things that Dr. Sadowski mentioned. And I think one of the question, the perspective was whether this decline in motor function is related to aging versus spinal canal narrowing, which is called spinal stenosis. The motor decline with aging that I mentioned in the introduction happens actually over at least a few decades, and it's very gradual. So the speed of decline actually matters. And in this case, if this person's been showing muscle weakness over 6 months, I'm actually more concerned about other reasons other than just normal aging on top of having transverse myelitis, such as spinal stenosis, it could be spinal tethering, it could be some other things too. So I think it's important that this person really goes to see a neurologist and have a thorough examination just to make sure there's nothing else going on top of transverse myelitis.
And that's why is that important? Because some of these causes are reversible.
Correct.
Okay. Yep. That makes sense. So it seems like the speed of the decline matters in terms of figuring out the potential cause of the decline. So that's a really good point. And so then I know I talked to Maureen a little bit about this as well. And Maureen, feel free to chime in. We did get a question about, someone was diagnosed with TM in 2009 and they were paralyzed from the waist down and they're now 64 and they want to know kind of what their prognosis is in terms of life expectancy. And I know Maureen, you also, that's a question you've thought about as well. And something that I've personally also thought about as well. I was diagnosed when I was 21. So, I was also thinking about that too. Would you mind talking a little bit about that, Dr. Sadowski?
Okay. Yeah, sure. I can improvise on that because there is actually no data that says, if you're here, what's going to happen? There is some data that I can but it's from traumatic spinal cord injury. There are life expectancy data according to the time at which the neurologic deficit occurs. I'm going to start with, it also depends on, so the person was injured in 2009. It depends on what is the motor and sensory function that's residual. Is this a complete paralysis below the waist, or is this a partial paralysis? How active were they in 2000, following the paralysis? Are they bedbound, wheelchair confined? Generally speaking, if I will have to give some sort of prognosis, I have to open maybe. There is a database that looks at individuals with, again, traumatic spinal cord injury and how long they live according to how bad their paralysis is, at what age that occur. And while I'm talking, I can look at it because I can give you specific numbers, but that's not for transverse myelitis. It's just that transverse myelitis does look neurologically similar to a traumatic spinal cord injury. So I'm trying to get that information.
No problem. We can come back to it when, if you're able to pull it up, but yeah, I know it's hard.
I'll do that. I'm going to look at it and we'll come back. I promise.
That works. No problem. We did get another question too. And I think Maureen, you can talk a little bit about your experience as well. This person's 21-year-old child has had TM for 19 years. She has left leg weakness that has resulted in significant stress on her knee and hip, although she wears a brace, and she experiences daily orthopedic and nerve pain. Based on what you've seen in others with TM, what can we expect for her physically in 10 years and 20 years, and what are the best ways for her to maximize her physical function and comfort?
that. Who's going to take that one?
It's, I'm not sure, whoever.
What's that question? Which number is that?
Which number?
Number six.
Yeah.
So just, you know, talking about, you know, so this person was diagnosed as a child and then kind of looking forward 10 and 20 years, you know, what can they expect for her physically?
I'm going to say that expect to maintain function.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. I was about to say that you expect to maintain function. As long as there is ongoing coordinated care, so you can't you can do overuse, and you will overuse. But as long as your joints and your muscles, but as long as you ongoingly see a professional that knows how to prevent complications and or how to address them early. And the musculoskeletal complications are the ones that happen the quickest. So if you have shoulder pain because of crutch use, if you let it go for 3 years, chances are the pain won't be reversed or you're going to need surgery. But if you address it with a professional when it's 2 or 3 months into the occurrence, not only that the pain can be managed, but also measures to prevent degenerative changes and complication can be implemented. And that is the role of the rehabilitation professional, be it an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, or a physiatrist like myself and Dr. Chung.
Thank you. And Maureen, can you just talk a little bit about your experience, like how you've manage. I know you mentioned, you know, your progression with different kind of mobility devices. Did you work with a physician or how did you, you know, how have you managed your care in the past, you know, several years?
I would just echo that having a physician or a therapist supervise what's ever going on in your life as you're walking through these years. I was pretty much on my own and just basically persevering, doing the best I could do to get from point A to point B. And I would, you know, even remember boasting of my upper body strength and, oh, look how strong I am. But later on, I saw that because of using my arms basically to hold up my body to walk, I was doing damage to my shoulders, and now I have shoulder pain. Now I have elbow and wrist pain. And if only I had, you know, been seen by someone along the way that would say, whoa, wait a minute here, we shouldn't be doing this because you're hurting yourself. And yes, you're maybe being successful to some degree, but at the same time, you're doing damage. And I would just warn people as they're going through this aging with the disability to have, you know, that professional pair of eyes helping you out.
You make a very, very good point here, and I'd like to put it into the context of an Olympian or a high-level athlete. They have, all of the high-level athletes have superior medical and training support. A person with a paralysis related to transverse myelitis or any other spinal cord related disease is functioning as an athlete, because you have less resources and you're supposed to do the same amount of motor activity. So with that in mind, you wouldn't think that Alex Rodriguez went through his career without having a doctor and a trainer. Why would you expect an individual that has paralysis, motor weakness related to paralysis, going through life without the same.
Right, right. That's a really good point. Thank you both for speaking to that issue. So kind of relatedly, there's kind of two questions. One is, you know, how can someone differentiate between just aging and the issues that come with that and something like a rare, you know, neuroimmune cause? I know we talked a little bit about, you know, the time frame of, you know, a decline happening, whether that's, you know, from the, you know, stenosis or from something else. So one, you know, how to differentiate between aging and something that's being caused by the rare neuroimmune disorder. And then also, you know, how to modify or adjust, you know, or speak to their healthcare team about managing the condition as they get older.
So so the number one question, I think, how to differentiate between just normal aging process versus other neuromuscular or neurological disorder, correct? So well, currently, I think there's actually no technical ways to differentiate at this point, to be honest. This is actually part of my research process. I think I'm more particularly interested in neuromuscular function, which I believe to be the first signs of motor neuron decline with aging. But it's not like currently there's any clinical tools such as electromyography or MRI or EMGs or anything like that to be able to differentiate, you know, normal aging process from a certain neurological kind of process. It's more clinical judgment. So I think it's whenever anybody, especially with any neurological disorder, underlying neurological disorder, such as transverse myelitis and chronic spinal cord injury patients, if they're experiencing motor decline, as I said in the beginning, the speed of decline, I think, is very important. And again, basically from big epidemiological studies, we know that the motor function decline starts actually pretty early in their lifespan. Some people argue that maybe like in their mid-30s and early 40s, and definitely by 50s and 60s, if you look at the clinical studies before, there's actually significant motor function decline going on. But a lot of people, normal people, they may not notice that because they're coming from pretty strong baseline. So even though they may not be as strong as they used to be in their 20s and 30s, if you actually measure grip strength or certain measures, they may notice a certain difference there too. But again, this happens very gradually over 20, 30 years, so a lot of people may not notice that. So any acute decline that's actually suggesting some other neurological events going on. And I think more important thing is if they notice any strength decline going on, they have to do a thorough neurological exam to rule out other possibilities. And let's say if the the motor function decline or muscle weakness is happening kind of in a slow speed and other things after thorough exam have been all ruled out, then maybe we can retrospectively think that this is probably related to normal aging, especially given that in spinal cord injury patients, they have a very low number of motor neurons and they may present this motor neuron aging more dramatically. But otherwise, I think still it's really important to completely rule out other neurological conditions at this point. I think number two question was, what are the things that that can be done to prevent or treat the normal aging and neuromuscular decline? Again, like I said in the beginning, a lot of this research is done in an animal models and all these molecular studies, but this research actually has been relatively recent. I mean, surprisingly, you know, the problem with aging has been there for many thousand years, but we still don't know a lot about this, and still a lot of these clinical, the research studies very preliminary, and there have not been a lot of clinical, studies to show what are the good interventions to prevent it. Now, up until at this point, the best evidence for any type of intervention for aging there are two things, which are calorie restriction and exercise. Now, these two things, again, are based on the animal studies, and, you know, doing the calorie restriction is actually not an easy thing for, you know, human being, and there's a lot of ethical concern at this related to calorie restriction and, you know, on actual human person. However, in like animal studies, particularly in mice and rats, if you do calorie restriction for entire life from the birth to their death, and a lot of rodents, their lifespan is about just a few years, so we can actually kind of starve them a little bit for entire lifespan, and they can increase their lifespan by 20-30%. And another thing that can and that's been really reproduced in a lot of different labs, and we know that calorie restriction really is the intervention, at least in the animal models, that can increase the lifespan, and also it can delay the neuromuscular decline. Another thing is exercise, and we can actually exercise these animals in the lab. We can exercise these animals for, you know, pretty much a quite significant portion of their entire lifespan. We exercise them for example, 6 months, which would have been 25% of their entire life, which may be impractical for a lot of humans, but we know that this aggressive exercise intervention can delay the onset and also progression of you know, age-related muscle weakness as well. Now, the million-dollar question is whether these two interventions apply to human. We actually do not know. But given this, I mean, calorie restriction is a little bit still very controversial topic in aging field, but exercise, you know, generally there's a lot of other benefits of doing exercise. So, so generally based on this animal model, our knowledge is from basic science research, I usually recommend exercise, especially if people with the transverse myelitis and spinal cord injury, with aging, you know, given the limited options we have, and also given the, you know, lack of, I mean, not much of a side effect from the exercise, I strongly recommend exercise for this population.
Great, thank you. Let's see. So we also got a question, Dr. Zadowski. I know you talked a little bit about this in your presentation, but, you know, people with transverse myelitis and the other rare neuroimmune disorders often have bladder incontinence or issues with bladder function. One person wrote that as they age, their bladder incontinence is getting worse, which I know happens in the non-rare neuroimmune disorder population as well. So is there anything that can be done to help that? And then also, you know, are there any kind of risks with years of catheterizing, you know, if you're diagnosed at a young age and, you know, you have to catheterize your whole life, are there any like increased risks with that as well?
Sure. So let's start with what to do if you have worsening worsening bladder function. I would say, first of all, look for a specialist that has knowledge in neurourology or in neurogenic bladders, and they can be urologists or they can be spinal cord injury medicine specialists. There are a bunch of tests that can tell you how the bladder functions. One of them is called urodynamic studies, in which there is water normosaline that's instilled into the bladder, and the pressures and electrical activity, muscle activity is recorded. So the doctor can look at that specific test and say, hey, your bladder is strong, but it has muscle spasms, and that's why you're incontinent, or your bladder is okay, but it is a little on the small side, and that's why you have urinary incontinence, because it can't accommodate the volume, or your sphincter is lax, and that's why you're leaking. So all these answers can be gathered with basically one test. Doctors never stop with the one test, and I'm one of them. I can attest for that. But again, we have good tools, therapeutic, good diagnostics tools to figure out how, why is your bladder incontinent? Why is it not working as it's supposed to work? So that's number one. Number two is there are drugs. There are medications that can help with the different conditions that you identify in that test. So there are medications that can help with relaxing the bladder, with taking away the bladder spasms. There are small non-invasive procedures that can help with sphincter incontinence. And then there are more extensive surgical procedures that, you know, might be implemented at some point or another. Although I have to say that in people with neurogenic bladder, they are not as much performed as in other individuals. Like the incontinent lax pelvis after a woman gave birth to 2 or 3 or 5 kids, that gives a specific type of incontinence, and that is treated mostly with surgery. And that, but that doesn't occur so much if you have the spastic paralysis, the flaccid paralysis, then yeah, it might happen. There was something else that you asked me, and I'm apologizing, Gigi. What was that? What was the second question?
Just about kind of like the long-term effects of having of like intermittent self-catheterization, or having, you know, an indwelling catheter, you know, if there's any kind of long-term issues going forward as you age with that.
Yeah, so, well, when you have intermittent catheterization or an indwelling catheter, you have a more likelihood of having recurrent urinary tract infection. So traditionally, we like to keep the number of urinary tract infection under 4 per year. If you have more than that, you're going to need some sort of help from a professional onto treating that. Because not only that, recurrent urinary tract infection increase the inflammation in the body, and pro-inflammatory status is not something that it's usually a good chronic condition situation. Inflammation raises a bunch it raises the likelihood of having a bunch of comorbidities that are going from gut dysfunction all the way to increased likelihood of having cardiovascular conditions. So just raising the inflammatory status in the body is not a good thing. Specifically, having, again, recurrent UTIs can lead at the risk for increased renal and bladder stones, which in themselves come with raise inflammation and with pain and quality of life changes. There were some old studies that were talking about an increased likelihood of having a specific bladder cancer called transitional cell carcinoma. That I'm not so sure that that's still valid. That was reported in the 70s, and it was mostly in males that had traumatic spinal cord injury and had a suprapubic catheter or a Foley catheter that stayed there for years and years. And one of the studies showed an increased likelihood of, if you have that indwelling catheter for 10 years or more, you have this likelihood of increased transitional cell carcinoma. So what I do with my patients, I each year look for cytology, or if they have a urologist, I ask them to do cystoscopy to look on the inside if you have an indwelling catheter, just to make sure that there are not chronic changes, that because all these inflammatory changes in the bladder can at some point mutate into abnormal cytology, abnormal cells, which abnormal cytology can equal some sort of a cancer. So those would be my main concerns. If you have a high pressure bladder, which is a very spastic bladder, you can also have swelling of the kidneys, which carries the medical term of hydronephrosis, and that is really, really bad because the swelling is actually killing the cells that are processing the toxins. in the kidney, and you run the risk of renal insufficiency / failure. Let's see, what else can I scare you with? I'm going to stop. You ask a doctor what can go wrong.
Right.
And by the way, I did find all that, the numbers that we could generalize for the spinal cord injury life expectancy. So if you have an injury at the age of 20 and you have an incomplete injury, you're expected to live about 54 years. If you have a ventilator-dependent injury and you're injured at 20, you're expected to live about 18 years. If you're injured at 40 with an incomplete injury, age expectancy is 35.6 years. If you're ventilator-dependent, it's 13. If you're injured at 60 and have an incomplete injury, your lifespan is 20 more years. And if you're ventilator dependent, it's only 8 more years. Now, this is specifically for traumatic spinal cord injury. This is data that has been published at the end of 2017. And in fact, it gets updated almost on a yearly basis. If anybody cares to extrapolate to their, you know, to the transverse myelitis condition, it is found on the web at the University of Alabama, uab.edu, and it's under the heading of Facts and Figures at a Glance.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. And as we're, you know, we're heading to the end, I just wanted to open up to Maureen if you had any, you know, questions or anything specific you wanted to talk about as well. I wanted to give you the opportunity to do that.
Well, a bit of humor just rises up in me as I'm listening to these conversations, how my physician commented to me that, you know, the warranty expires at 40, so everything after that is going to be pretty much downhill.
Oh.
but I fight that. And anyway, just need to smile once in a while.
Yep. Okay, and then I just have one more quick question, because I know we only have about 3 minutes left. We've talked to, you know, a lot about paralysis and, you know, issues with bladder and bowel function. Someone doesn't have paralysis, but they've lived with NMO for 7 years, and most of their issues are related to vision loss and some mobility. And is there anything that, you know, different that they should expect while aging? They're currently 53. Dr. Sadowski?
What are the issues? Vision loss, you said?
Yeah, so they have, you know, neuromyelitis optica, and their most of their issues are...
Yeah, no. So their residuals are decreased mobility and vision loss?
Right.
Well, kind of that chunk mentioned that, he mentioned that the cure, the fountain of use is exercise. Well, the mobility impairment is the opposite. It's 180 degrees to if the exercise and increased activity is to the right, is to the plus, is increasing age, in, well, lifespan, and decreasing functional or dysfunction of day-to-day neurologic function. The immobility actually compounds all of the issues. So I'm not expecting, if you increase your level of activity, the burden of mobility of dysfunction will decrease. It doesn't matter if it's related to NMO, TM, ADEM, chronic myelopathy. Probably the only part in which I can't say that that only activity plays the major role is if you have a dysfunction related to a tumor, because that's the only one that I can't control. But the tumor plays an essential role. But otherwise, if it is an immune dysfunction induced paralysis or decreased mobility, if you add the exercise or the activity, increase the activity, because activity increases neurogenesis, increases synapse formation and remyelination. So as long as you use one intervention, and that's activity, to combat all of dysfunction related to whatever your etiology is, then you're going to prevent some secondary complications. I will not comment on vision because I only treat patients from the neck down.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you all so much. We're actually at the end of our time. I just wanted to remind the listeners that we did record this and it will be made available on our website and on iTunes. So thank you so much, Maureen, Dr. Chung, and Dr. Sadowski. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.